This episode of the Real Talks podcast is brought to you thanks to the MGF Group, a premier building material supplier in New York City. Whether you're a seasoned contractor or a DIY enthusiast, the MGF Group offers a wide range of premium building materials to suit your every need. From cement to lumber, protection materials and safety nets, the MGF Group has got it all under one roof and pride themselves in timely and reliable delivery. Check out the mgfgroup.com for more information.
This episode of the Real Talks podcast is brought to you thanks to the Taylor Public House. Right on the doorstep of Madison Square Garden, the Taylor Public House is the perfect place to connect with family or friends before taking in a concert or sports event. The Taylor is known for its warm welcome, classy ambiance, and comfort food. It has two floors, three bars, and two private event spaces for parties and gatherings. Be sure to stop by and experience the Taylor Public House for yourself, located in the heart of Midtown Manhattan on the corner of 35th Street and 8th Avenue. Check out thetaylornyc.com for more information.
Hello there. Welcome to the Real Talks podcast. I'm Alan O'Mara, an author, speaker, and mental performance coach with sports teams in the US and Ireland. We originated this podcast in County Cavan, Ireland, where I'm from, and are coming to you this season from New York City, where I'm based now. In this new season of the Real Talks podcast, we're diving into meaningful conversations about life journeys and all things mental health with guests from the global Irish community. With that, I'm so happy to be joined by this week's guest, Evanne Quillen. Evanne is an Irish sports journalist and television presenter. She is also the author of the great Irish book of Gaelic Games. This is a conversation I've wanted to have for a long time, so I'm absolutely delighted to be sitting down today for what I know is going to be a wide-ranging chat. Evanne, you're very welcome to the Real Talks podcast.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me. I've actually been looking forward to it for a while too. I think we've been trying to do this for ages.
Yes, we had a couple of different schedule and conflicts and a few different things, and we had some tech gremlins today trying to derail us, but we're here now and talking now, and I'm really, really happy to be chatting to you, Evanne. So thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you're busy.
My pleasure. Honestly, my pleasure.
Yeah, let's start with if it's okay with you, I was going to start with the book, because I think most people will be familiar with you in terms of being on TV, sports presenter on the 6-1 News, but multiple Olympic coverage or GA coverage. And certainly, you know, I think I crossed passage years ago when I was working in like Croke Park in the communications department, they would have seen you coming and going. So maybe we'll jump straight to the book, because that's kind of like a little side road you took off the main street that you were heading down. And tell us a little bit about the motivation behind the great Irish book of Gaelic Games, where that came from and kind of what inspired you to do it.
You know what? You're so right. It is a sidetrack, but I'm all about the sidetracks. I've always been like that. And even going back way before the book, when I was probably 10 years in RTE, I decided to go back and do a master's, and I kind of did that part-time over 2 years. I'm the type of person that needs to be challenged. And it's not that my job doesn't challenge me, it does, but sometimes I feel like everybody can get into a comfort zone and everybody can get into a place where they're not challenged. And I love being challenged, and I work best under pressure, and I always have. So I always look around to see what else I can do, because I don't think we can be defined by what we do for a living or what we do day to day. I think there's always more. And it's not that the book was something, you know, that I thought was going to change my life or anything. It was another sidetrack and another distraction and another challenge and something I had never done before. So that's why when the opportunity came up, I jumped at it, because I'm always looking for those types of challenges. So the way that it came about, this particular book, was Gill, the publishing house, got in contact with me. They bring out one of these books every year, the Great Irish Book of Science or Politics or History. And they try and find somebody in the public eye that will, you know, carry the book and write the book and be the face of the book or whatever. So they came to me about this idea. They wanted to do the Great Irish Book of GAA. And they rang me about it. And I knew the books because my kids had the one about the farm. And I knew about the series, and I had a good chat, and I was really excited about it. But I said, yes, I'd love to do that, but we can't call it that. You can't call it the Great Irish Book of the GAA, because it's just so small minded. And, you know, it's such a small part of Gaelic Games. So in fairness to the publishers, they didn't, you know, the editor that I was speaking to didn't actually realize that you would be isolating women and all sorts of other things if you just do the GAA. So that's how it became the Great Irish Book of Gaelic Games. Because I wanted to make sure that everybody in the Gaelic Games family was represented in the book. I wanted, if you had any kind of an inclination towards the sports or the things that are affiliated with the Gaelic Games, I wanted to make sure that you could open the book and see yourself, whether that's, you know, Puck Father champion or a score champion or somebody that loves the Irish language and the connection that we have, you know, with between the language and the sport and why that connection is there. Like, in a sense, the GAA itself was founded to try and protect Gaelic life and protect Gaelic language, culture, music, just the social life of Gaels during British rule. So I wanted to make sure that that was all in the book, and that if children did pick it up and read it, that they had a whole kind of evaluation of what it means to be a Gael or what it means to have an involvement in Gaelic games. So that's why, you know, there's a section on the history of it, but there's also a section on county nicknames, county colours, go games or score, Fela, all of that stuff is in there. And obviously so is ladies football, camogie, rounders, handball, the sports that sometimes don't get the limelight. So that was really important to me when they came to me with the idea. And I don't think that the publishers realised how much was in it. I don't think they realised how many stones we could unturn and how many different stories we could tell. So I'm thrilled with it. And obviously I only did half the work. The illustrator, Donna, did an amazing job bringing it to life. I was writing in Word document and sending it in and, you know, humming and hawing over words and word counts. And I found that really hard, actually, some of the chapters around, you know, I wanted to do a whole, like, dynasties of Gaelic football and trends and how football had changed and stuff. And it's just like, you know, they were like, Ivan, these kids are born post 2010. They don't necessarily need to know what happened in the 30s and how the game changed between the 30s and the 70s. So I got a bit nerdy at times and they had to pull me back in. And that in itself was a challenge, you know, writing for kids and making sure it jumped off the page. And obviously the illustrator did the bulk of that because, you know, he brought it to life, Donal O'Malley. He did a fantastic job. I absolutely love the illustrations.
Yeah, it sounds like such, even as I'm listening to you there, like as you're like retelling it, like you're almost smiling, like you are smiling and at different variations of like reflecting back on it. And like, it sounds like it became quite like a project that, for you, like it was important, was like the breadth of the GAA and the variety of what it has to offer people as well. Because I think we're all guilty at times, including myself, of, you know, the All-Ireland Championships on, or like the elitist part of it in terms of the media focus or the competitive or the competitor. But also, as you like boil down into kids' lives and like, you know, different towns and counties and villages across Ireland, also across the world now as well, which is a whole other part.
Oh yeah, that's like, that's one of my favorite pages, is, you know, the GAA around the world. And I know you have experienced that at a very, and especially at the moment as a manager over there. But like, for me, the biggest thing was inclusion. And I think sometimes we can be exclusive when it comes to, you know, or are you a real, you know, Gaelic Games head, or, you know, do you just dip your toe in? Dip your toe in, the more the merrier, like get on the bandwagon if you want. Like, I just wanted to make sure that people could open it and see whether they spend, you know, 7 days a week up in the club, or, you know, one evening a week up in the club, or if you're not even in a club, just feel like you can be included, even if it's in a small way. That was a big thing for me too, because I don't like when people kind of get a bit elitist around, you know, oh, I'm a big GAA head, or I'm a big rugby head or whatever. Just throw the doors open and let everybody in. And that was kind of one of the reasons why I wrote the book the way I did write the book. And I think if Gail had gone to a different journalist to write the book, it would have been a different book. And that's the beauty of it too.
Yeah, like, well, like with all that too, like I think of, like, in terms of like, especially trying to engage kids, I know you kind of tip the hat to the illustrator who's able to do that as well. But like, I think it's important that you want children knowing that, yes, like sport can be like really competitive and you can go down that avenue. But in terms of opportunities for connection and friendships and different passions and interests, it's far more like, it's more, there's a wider spread on things that you can find bits that you enjoy. Like, you know, say for the GAA perspective, you mentioned score, or like you mentioned, if it's like just the various different, like handball or rounders or those kind of, there's different things that are wrapped around the GAA that even as myself growing up, like I didn't even know about half the time, you know, and trying to help people understand the wider, I suppose, scope of, as you said, the GAA, because it goes back and obviously grounded much further in history. It's not just a sporting organization. I think it sounds like you did such a great job along with the team of people around you of bringing that together and then bringing it to life. And it must have made you really proud as you kind of did. Did you get to do like the little kind of book tour and the whistle stop tour around different places promoting it? Like, what was that like for you?
That, do you know, it's funny. The whole way through the process, I was just enjoying the process. I used to go to the library locally here when I dropped the kids to school, and then I'd go to the library and have my little nerdy 4 hours and sit there and research and write. And I completely forgot. And nobody kind of warned me for it about having to actually try and sell the book. I didn't think about having to go and do a launch or having to go and do a tour. I didn't do a tour necessarily. I went to a few schools, and I'm still going to, you know, like a couple of schools, like, and I mean literally a couple. I don't have time, like a couple of libraries and stuff during book week. And I'll do a couple of festivals. But like, I found that really hard actually to fit that in. And I didn't, I bet you there's people out there who write the book with the book tour in mind, you know, but I was the complete opposite. I just enjoyed writing the book, and I'd love to write another book or more books, but it would nearly stop me from doing it. The thoughts of having to do the tours and sell the book. I just like writing. But having said that, I certainly enjoyed launching it. You know, I had a very small launch. It was mostly family and friends. But at the same time, it was a nice achievement. It was an accomplishment that I was able to share with people that I love and people that helped me through it too, because I couldn't have written it without help from, you know, well, my partner, first of all, my husband, but also even just my mom. The odd time would come up and I'd go to the library for a few hours. Like, I had a newborn when I started writing this book. He was probably 6 or 8 months old. So it wasn't easy. And 2 older kids that are training every night of the week and going here, there and everywhere. So it certainly wasn't easy doing it on top of a full-time job, but it was really, really enjoyable. I definitely enjoyed writing it more than I did like trying to actually sell it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes a lot of sense too, given like your career and like skill set and bits of probably, you know, you going back, I'm sure you've done the researcher part to sports journalism and the producer and the editor and all that stuff. So kind of getting to piece things together. And like, I suppose when that final product does come together, Ivan, what was it like, I'm curious, in terms of sitting down with your own kids? I know you mentioned 2 of them were older, in terms of showing them the book. And had they been like, we've heard this already, mom, like you already talked to us about this stuff? Or are they like taking it in fresh? What was that kind of like sitting down with them?
Honestly,
to show them it?
Like by the time it came out, they had seen a few sketches and they had seen a few versions, particularly my eldest, he's 12 now. So when I first started writing it, he was probably 10 and a half. He just turned 12. So he was probably about 10 and a half when I first started writing it. And I used to bounce a lot of it off him in terms of, you know, whether or not it was engaging or whether it was boring or that kind of thing. So, and then he had seen like some of the sketches that came, the early sketches that came back were black and white. So he had seen a few bits. Like my daughter was only she was probably only 6 or that when I started writing it, and because she's in a Gael school, she hadn't learned how to read English yet. So, because they don't learn how to read English, or they don't do the, like, whatever it's called, the phonics or whatever they call them. They don't actually do them until I think senior infants or something. So, whatever age she was, she actually couldn't read yet. So she was kind of useless to me at the time. But no, my eldest son, and he's such a sports nut as well. That he was great, and he still pick it up every so often now and, you know, learn something that he didn't really realize before, which I think is brilliant. But I've had a lot of adults come to me and say that they pick it up off the coffee table every now and then and have a little read of it, even if it's for 10 minutes, and they often learn something that they didn't know. And that's the beauty of it, really, isn't it? Just little
that is brilliant.
And that's kind of the way I wanted to write it, was nuggets. Like, I wanted a couple of nuggets on every page, so that if you did pick it up and read it for 5 minutes, you might see something that you didn't know before.
No, like, I absolutely love that. I think it's something that I think it's a really cool thing that you did. And, you know, you talk about like that's a book and a project that will last a long time, but that'll be around sitting on coffee tables, and you'll get a message in 20 years time from someone who's picked it up. You will, like, you just will. That's one of the cool things about, I suppose, books. And like, you know, my own experience, I still get the odd messages every now and again from, sometimes you think, oh, that's a lifetime ago, because you move on to like the next project and you're doing like the next thing, and then you kind of get like, oh, so I just saw this in the airport, or I just read this on my train journey. And it's always really nice that they just kind of stand the test of time like that. I think like coming back closer to like, in terms of the work side of it, in terms of like, you have been working as a journalist for pretty much your whole adult life, right? Like, that's been your career throughout, has it?
Yeah. So what are we now, 2024? I finished college in 2004. I came out of, I did an undergrad in DCU and a postgrad in Galway. And when I came out in May of 2004, that's 20 years ago now. And I've been working in sports, broadcasting and journalism for that whole time. Obviously, my role has changed significantly since then. I did start off as a kind of a researcher, sub-editor, and even shortlisting, like literally shortlisting and doing nothing else during the 2004 Olympics. So yeah, it has been, I actually can't believe it's been 20 years. I don't really feel 20 years older than I was. It has been varied, in fairness. It has been varied. Mm-hmm. And like I said at the very beginning of this chat, I have always had a life outside of my job, and I've looked for challenges for myself outside of just what I do for a living. So I think if I didn't do that, I just wouldn't be able to not do that. It's just the way I'm wired. I get kind of, if I get comfortable or if I get, and I'm not going to say bored, because I'm never bored. I'm always busy, probably by design, but I'll always look for challenges, and I'll always look for the next thing that I want to take on. And sometimes I have to be careful.
Bit of variety.
Yeah, but sometimes I have to be careful, because a lot of the time, and my husband says this to me all the time, I take on too much. So then I run around like a blue arse fly, and I get overwhelmed because I know I'm not doing everything to 100%. It's my own fault because I took on too much. So it's a vicious circle, but I wouldn't really have it any other way. It's just the way I'm built.
I suppose with that too, like, there's times where you can almost burn yourself out too, because you're spreading yourself too thin and trying to push through. And then I'm sure, as 20 years ago, you didn't have, you know, three kids that were looking for mommies to take them here there, or do whatever else. So it's probably part of, like, I mean, learning to, I suppose it's a classic, learn to say no, but also then just picking and choosing your battles, I'm sure, as well, in terms of what is the next project, or what it is that you want to do while also working and doing the work that you do so well. And I know, like over the years, you've covered so many big sport moments and such big parts of Irish history. But like, I suppose today I was kind of curious, in terms of, as you sit here today, kind of reflecting on the growth of women's sport, like I was going to say in Ireland, but also like globally. Like, I'm in New York here, and I know like the NCAA tournament got lit up over the last couple of months stuff. Like, I was watching it myself and seeing like those sports breaking through and transcending like traditional barriers or limitations and attitudes. And what's it been like for you, kind of being at very much the forefront, not the forefront, but certainly like right in the front seat of that ride as it's kind of breaking through for yourself? And what's that kind of part of the journey been like, Ivan?
I've always been really surprised at how much a battle, I've been surprised at how much of a battle it has been for women's sport to just get a moment. Because if you think about it, even from, say you're a marketer, or say you're somebody that works in business, and you're trying to see what, you know, the next big product is that you need to sell. Women buy stuff. Women are consumers. Women are marketable. And I have found it so interesting to see how long it has taken the industry to wake up and realize that backing women is a winner, and that sponsoring women's teams is an easy win. And that's just looking at it from a selfish point of view, from the point of view of, like, you know, rights holders and advertisers and that. And then you have the fact that women's sport is a real spectacle. And again, people haven't, just, they took them so long to wake up to that. And I mean, you mentioned the NCAA, like the March Madness stuff, like, I mean, Caitlin Clark, some of the records that she is setting and some of the attendances and the TV audiences, they're breaking the mold when it comes to men's sport. Same for, I think it was the US Open final, women's final, broke TV viewership for, I'm talking about tennis now, for the men's final. The Women's World Cup, every time there's a World Cup, every record is reset, everything is broken. So we're on the crest of a wave. I just find it so hard to believe that it took this long for the rest of the world to wake up. Because people who always watch sport and people who always watched women's sport are not surprised at how good the spectacle is and how much people love it when it does happen. Because if you build it, they will come. And that is, that's the biggest thing, I think, that I just can't believe it's taken this long for people to realise that this would be successful and this would be profitable and this would be something that would be positive, not just for society and for young girls watching it, but also, like, if you want to sell a product, put it in front of a load of women. It's going to get bought. Like, it's not rocket science. So, yeah, I suppose I'm just surprised that it's taken this long. However, I do think that, like, we're not finished. Like, we're not nearly where we need to be at. And I still think that there's a lot of battling there when it comes to editorial, and that you have to really work a bit harder to make sure that the women's stories are getting into the headlines. And I'm speaking from the point of view of somebody who works in a newsroom and has to push stories and has to make sure that certain stories get airtime. And you still sometimes have to push to make sure that there's a women's story in your bulletin or on your website. And if there aren't any pushers there, you're going to struggle. So we still need more pushers, because it's like, it's kind of like gender quotas. You have to force it for a while before it becomes normalized. And there is a good example of the national broadcaster in Sweden who, they basically just decided, the head of sport basically just decided, right, we're going to set targets. So every single day we have to have a certain target of women's sport in our bulletins and on our online content. And she enforced targets until it became normal to do it. So that's just an example of how sometimes you have to force something for it to work. And while I don't really, I mean, there are gender quotas on boards and gender quotas in general are a bit divisive, but sometimes with, you know, the coverage of women's sport, or even if it's just headlines and that, sometimes it's just challenging unconscious bias and making sure that people are looking at their unconscious bias and saying, well, if that was a man that just won a junior European gold medal, you'd probably put it on the news. So maybe we should put the woman who just won a European junior gold medal or whatever. So, yeah, I think we have a ways to go, yes, but it's certainly been an upward curve.
Yeah, like, I 100% agree with you. And it's like that, it's that feeling sometimes of, you know, like if you're trying to push a boulder up a hill and it's like, well, if you stop pushing, like, you're going to lose and it rolls all the way back to the bottom. And like, I totally understand, like, multiple people have been involved and you've mentioned there are people pushing it. And, but I think there's also a recognition right now of like that this, all the work that's been done is like to be commended and applauded. But I think also that feeling of just that women's sport just kind of like at the point now where it has like an actual foundation to really launch from now and to really like transcend into the next level of, where that's obviously people getting locked in on the media stuff, but also just as like, you know, match day fans going, whether that's a young boy going and watching a game, and just, as I say, going to watch a game, not a men's Gaelic football game or a ladies Gaelic football game. And I was talking to a female player recently and kind of, she said like for the first time, that she kind of feels like just the games are just being accepted and appreciated as just like that game. Like, it's not a comparison between A and B or C and D. Like, it's just, you want to go watch a game, go and watch a game and enjoy the game. I think that's all progressive stuff too.
It's like when they were talking about Katie Taylor and people were calling her a female boxer. Now, I know she's female and I know she's a boxer, but like, she's one of the best boxers ever. So can we stop calling her a female boxer? Like, we don't call tennis players a male tennis player. And yet, you know, Serena Williams for decades now, it's like, oh, you know, she's a great female tennis player. She's a great tennis player. You know, Leanne Kiernan is a great footballer. Katie Taylor is a great fighter. You know, she's a great boxer. Like, I think sometimes we have to, and female sports journalist. I get, like, this is what I get called that all the time. It's like, okay, 2 decades in the industry, can you not just call me a broadcaster?
Yeah, 100%. And that's, I think that was, I remember I spoke to, I'm sure you know Aisling Maher from, like, she plays Camogie with Dublin. And just, she said something to me that like always stuck with me when we were doing it. It was a podcast, it was on the Player's Voice, and it, but it always stuck with me. It was like, and someone had just when someone articulates something so clearly and like on the nose, where it's like sometimes we have to actively unlearn language that we use. Like, it's like that's the language we picked up, that's what we grew up around, but you actually have to like unlearn it, like strip it back. And like that's kind of what you're saying there reminds me of that, of like, because sometimes we have those unconscious biases with our language choices, and including myself, you say things sometimes, you go, actually that wasn't the right way of phrasing that or framing that. And that carries across, you know, into print media. Obviously you can see it very clearly because it's literally black and white. But I think those smaller things as well, because we can get, sometimes we search for like the big moments when it comes to sport promotion, or if it is like developing like media awareness. But also then sometimes it's about the little choices we all make like every day in our lives, if it's with your friends or with your kids, or sometimes it's with your parents, being like, actually no, that's not what, like, that's called, like, you don't we don't say that about,
and
that,
like,
thing.
It doesn't mean, like,
oh yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, and like, it's not your fault. Like, I don't like when people get defensive if you do kind of point out, maybe, you know, something around that, like the unconscious bias thing. Is not your fault. Like, you grew up in an environment and in a certain time when, you know, certain language and descriptions of women or anything was normal, and it was the only way, and we're all trying to unlearn certain things. I catch myself sometimes. I do think, obviously, you know, the younger you are, the less likely you are to catch yourself, because you're growing up in a more inclusive society. My son points out stuff to me if he hears somebody speaking about women or women's sport, particularly because he's mad into it. But and he's 12. So I'm kind of hoping in 10 years' time, it won't really be as much of an issue, because these boys are growing up in a far more progressive society and far more inclusive as well, an accepting society. So I think hopefully it won't be something that we all have to challenge our own unconscious bias in years to come, because people won't be growing up with them.
That definitely, like I said, it's like, and with all these big societal things we go through, like, it's never just a magic switch and it changes overnight. Like, it's the slow and steady boulder up the hill, constant like nudging at it and pushing at it. And I think and I hope that's something that's really changing our society. And that kind of brings me to one of the other things I wanted to talk about, Ivan, was back in 2018, you did the piece on it. It was the Sports Chronicle website at the time, You Never Really Know. And I remember reading it at the time. And like, obviously in terms of media and using your voice to try and create change is something I tried to do when I was younger. It was something I wanted to do back when, like in 2013, when I published my piece around mental health. And I suppose for anyone that hasn't read that piece, first of all, I'd say is just go search it. Just search Ivan's name and search the Sports Chronicle, because I felt like it was just a very powerful kind of story, and you using your voice to kind of promote multiple different things that had gone on in your life around, I suppose, it was losing your brother. There was a couple of different things at work and just different stuff like that. What kind of inspired you or kind of motivated you to kind of, you know, as a sports journalist, you're often kind of behind the camera or on the other side of the story. What kind of brought you to articulating like some of your life, some of your story, and sharing that on that platform?
Anytime I share something, I think about it a lot before I share it, because it's not easy putting yourself out there. And if anything, like, you're kind of making yourself more vulnerable. And you know this, like, when you share something that, you know, highlights your vulnerability or that makes you human, it's really not easy. However, I think it's more valuable to share those experiences when they happen or when you're strong enough to share them, because it's helping someone else. And if they can read it and relate to it and say, I felt the very same way, or that exact same thing happened to me, and, you know, it's interesting to read the way you navigated it. Again, it's about helping people not feel so isolated. So the more people can relate to one another, and it doesn't matter if, you know, you have a job in the media or that you're in the public eye. It just so happens that I am in the public eye. So I think by default, my voice is probably a little bit louder because I have that platform. So I think in one sense, I wish I didn't feel the need to use it. But in another sense, there's kind of a duty of care to other people to say, look, do you know what? We're all going through the shit. Like, we're all going through the ringer and we're all dealing with stuff, and it's not all roses, and really bad things happen, good people. And we have to acknowledge that. And like, I often think, oh, I wish I wasn't so much of a sharer. But at the same time, then I have people who come to me and say, oh, that really helped me when you like opened up about that, because I was going through the same thing and it just didn't feel as bad then when I thought I wasn't alone or whatever. And I'm thinking of stuff that's happened since that article. I'm thinking about stuff around infertility and that kind of thing. And even things that aren't, you know, massively, you know, taxing or whatever, but things like hyperemesis, and I don't even know if you know what that is, but like, it's a really horrible condition that you get, that some women get when they're pregnant. It's really, really bad. And I've had it three times now because I have three children. And it's horrific. And even something like that, sharing my experiences of that, has helped other people kind of try and just get through it. Migraine, like, it doesn't have to be, yes, I lost my brother to suicide and it was absolutely awful. But it doesn't have to be as tragic as that, and it doesn't have to be as dramatic as that. Sometimes it's just like, oh my God, I started running and I hate it and I really want to like it, but I don't hate it. Sometimes it's as simple as that, because also there's definitely someone else going through that as well.
Of course.
So I just think it's about being a human and just being... again, like, inclusive and just normalizing stuff, you know. There's too much, I hate secrets, I hate stuff getting brushed under the carpet, I hate people glossing over life. So that's why, like, Real Talks is, you know, it's a wonderful concept and I do buy into it, because there are real people under all of the public profiles that you see online or anywhere else. And everybody has the same crap, different shades of the same crap and different ways of dealing with it. But I think if you can, the more that you read or learn about other people navigating something that you're going through, it just lessens the load a little bit, doesn't it?
No, 100%. And like, I really appreciate you sharing that, Van, because I think like you covered multiple points there. And, you know, one is sometimes, okay, you feel like, oh, something like really, really bad has to happen in terms of before you can kind of share or speak up. But that's obviously, I've been that person too, of like, okay, I ended up right down the darkest end of the darkest path. And okay, I'll talk about that now. But also, as you said there, there's a whole middle ground of just all stuff we have to deal with, go through. And like the point you made, and I think it's a perfect example of it, is the condition from when you went through your pregnancy, it was called
hyperemesis.
Hyperemesis. Okay, sorry for the mispronunciation, but to your point, right, I didn't know about that. But because I was getting ready for this interview, I read an article you did, and I do know about it now. So like, if someone that I'm talking to has that, or their partner has that, or, you know, their sister has that or whatever, I'm able to be like, oh no, I've heard of that. Which, and sometimes when it comes to these things, whether they're, you know, whether they're to do with health or they seem trivial, but sometimes someone just being able to say, like, I've heard of that, like, it immediately, as you mentioned there, alluded to, like, the not feeling that you're on your own.
Yeah. And like, to be honest, like, men knowing about it is really important, because they feel, and let me tell you, like, my husband felt so helpless because there was nothing he could do. Like, and it's really, really hard to see your partner in that position. Like, it's obviously, you know, going in to have your baby and going into labor, and like, everybody expects that to be really hard on everybody, and it's a whatever. But nobody expects the pregnancy itself to put you in hospital, like, to have you so weak and, you know, unable to function without really heavy meds, which, by the way, are not on the drugs payment scheme. Like, there's so many issues around it. So I think, yeah, awareness is huge. And, you know, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole with hyperemesis, but like, if one more person, i.e. you, now knows about it, great. Because if somebody says they're suffering from it, you're like, oh my God, I heard about that. Are you okay? That's really awful. Is there anything I can do? Can I take your other children out for a walk?
Yeah.
You know?
No, and that's it. Like, I think there's such power in the, like, yes, so like, we've both been involved in the media side of it for sure, in terms of speaking publicly, but also just storytelling can happen, and like, creating empathy and connection can happen in smaller rooms and smaller conversations, in private conversations. But there might be eight people around a dinner table or a breakfast table or a bar top, and saying, actually, that's my experience at this. And again, there's the scale of, you know, by all means, significant issues that people do find harder to talk about. There's also stuff that we all no bother talking about. But then there's that middle ground of stuff that you just go through. And I think you can hand out all the leaflets you want in the world when it comes to things like mental health, or if it's with pregnancy, or if for me, if it's sports injuries, whatever the stuff are that come to mind. But ultimately, how we learn a lot of the time is storytelling and real talks and having conversations and be able to say to someone, oh, I never realized that before. Thanks for sharing that with me. And they go, oh, like, then they feel heard. And all of a sudden, like, a connection has just happened between humans. And that's ultimately how we're wired, and what we're wired for, was some of what we're wired for. Because I know, like, you had mentioned, like, the infertility earlier on, Ivan. I know that's been part of your story and part of your life over the last couple of years. And even myself and my partner, Mary Kay, we were talking about this recently, because, like, we were talking to a friend, and obviously, like, I'm in early 30s now, starting to get to mid-30s. But, like, you know, like, your friends and start going through different challenges and different things, and conversations start popping up, which you've never had before. And then you go back to, like, how you were educated as a kid. And I feel like I was almost laughing, because I feel like when you're in school, it was like, well, if you fancy that person, they fancy you, and you touch hands, like, you're going to be pregnant. You know what I mean? And then, like, but then, like, you get through, like, you learn about it. Like, no, that's not how, like, it works. And there's multiple issues and challenges. And people in my own life have gone through that. And there's still sometimes a shame or a stigma wrapped around even sharing that, and, like, opening up about that. And I think, again, from your, like, yourself had spoken about that, I think it's so important that people, like, share those experiences and stories, because there is someone somewhere feeling stigmatized, feeling shame, or feeling guilt, being like, oh, why can't I achieve this thing? And I'm not just talking about, say, pregnancy here, but that's just one example of this, where, you know, oh, you hear someone else has gone through that, and, like, there's like acceptance and connection, but then there's also a hope element to it too, which is sometimes we all just need a bit of hope and a bit of support. And the classic, I know it's a cliche, but, like, there could be light at the end of this tunnel, because you're allowed to feel exactly what you're feeling. There's no, like, when you're going through that journey. So I don't know, I'd imagine, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but as you open up with that chapter of your life, I'm sure you got lots of feedback and lots of conversations spun out of your experience and your journey, did it?
Yeah, big time. And I actually did a podcast, with Sinead O'War around it, when I was ready to talk about it. Like, you're not ready to talk about that stuff when you're going through it, because you're just trying to muddle through, and you're trying to stay positive. And to be honest, you mentioned the word hope, but it's actually a roller coaster of hope and despair, because every month you're like, well, here's hope, and then despair, and then hope, and then despair.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you are trying to function in the real world and not over obsess about what, you know, what that journey is doing to you. So yes, I spoke on a podcast while I was pregnant, actually, with my third, which is the one where it just took years. And yeah, I did get a pretty big response to that podcast, because it's just so many people, so many people related to it. And it's also something that is really silent. Because, like I say, when you're going through it, you don't want to talk about it. You're not able to talk about it. You're barely functioning. So if you can just throw the headphones on and listen to someone else going through it, I think it does help. And certainly from the feedback that I got from the podcast, it did help. It did help specific people just muddle through and feel a little bit less isolated. And I have family members who were going through something similar around that time. And even they felt a little bit less isolated, because not everyone's a talker. Like, I'm a talker, but not everyone's a talker. And, you know, family and friends who maybe are going through the same thing, maybe I mightn't know about it, or maybe, you know, whatever. But I think if you're not a talker, you can definitely be a listener. And it definitely does help. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of a no-brainer. Like, that's one of the biggest things that's really kind of not talked about is infertility, or not even infertility, but just this business of, you know, trying to have a baby. And everyone's like, oh, you don't tell anyone till 12 weeks. And it's like, why? And it's because you're afraid of it not working, or you're afraid of something happening. And I think we have a lot of work to do around just normalizing that journey, because it does become very, very secretive and very, very, like, it should be private if you want it to be private, but it shouldn't feel like something that you have a duty to hide, you know. Some people really want to talk openly about what's going on, you know, in the months around the time that they're, you know, trying to achieve something. So I think we're still a little bit, don't talk about women's issues in this country, but I do. Yeah, hopefully it's changing. I don't know. The only way to change it really is to just keep talking.
Yeah, I think so too. Like, you know, it's even for me, like, so on the male side of these issues, which you wouldn't be on your radar, and you are trying to like learn about as you get older, like, you need, like, it's, I go back to like storytelling and be able to like just pick up. So like, if it is someone ever in my life down the line, it's like, yeah, I don't know the ins and outs of all that, but like, sometimes just having the loosest sense of awareness or some sort of understanding of what the issue is helps that person just feel that little bit more comfortable sharing. And even when we talk about like real talks and sharing, like, I would always say, particularly like when it comes to mental health, and I've done stuff with, you know, in schools or with companies, it's like, hey, just because I wrote an article in the newspaper, doesn't mean like that's not the definition of sharing. Like, sometimes it's just, like I said, talking to four people about it and just getting that first conversation kind of out. Because sometimes people can kind of push it, sharing it seems so far down that it's actually come back to like the one person you trust or the two or three people. And hey, you might have a friend who is a really good friend, but they might be the person to share this thing with, because, you know, it doesn't always, you have to try and identify the right people to chat to and talk to. And like, to that point as well, if I just, because I know, like, as we kind of look to wrap up this, I did want to talk to you about, like, within the Sports Chronicle article, I know you spoke about your brother, and like, I don't want to take you down the whole path of what happened and the issues that existed with Corn beforehand, but if it's okay with you, like, I was curious around just kind of your experience of grief as a sibling, I suppose, because I know from chatting with Mary Kate, my partner, and she's producer on the podcast, like, Mary Kay's lost a sibling, and like, we talked before about, you know, there's research or there's resources around, you know, maybe a parent losing a kid or a kid losing a parent, but I kind of feel like there was a lack of stuff there for siblings, and I was kind of just curious, because there'll be lots of people listening to this who maybe have experienced that or had to navigate that, kind of what your experience was of that and kind of what was able to help, the challenges of it, because like we've just talked about sharing stories and experiences, if you're comfortable, I kind of love to hear kind of your take on that and kind of how you're able just to navigate through what is a really difficult thing and a really difficult time in life.
It's really hard because you're grieving as a sibling, but you're also grieving for what your parents have lost. Like, no parent should have to lose a child. And a lot of my grief was just feeling so sad for my parents because, you know, Cormac went through a lot of struggles with mental health and addiction, and my parents tried everything for him. Like, there was no stone unturned when it came to, like, you know, therapies or like counseling or you know, medical professionals, psychological help. They tried to help him in literally every way that they could, to probably the detriment of their own mental health at times as well. So for me, I think the difficult thing is that you're grieving your own sibling, but you're also looking at your parents and thinking, God, they should not have to go through this. It is absolutely awful. But you're right in that people immediately think about the parents and the mom and the dad who have had to, you know, bury their child. It's absolutely awful. And sometimes people forget about the siblings. And I don't know why that is, because, you know, Cormac and I were 2 years apart. So when we were kids, like, we did everything together. And I think it's a really important thing to deal with your grief as a sibling as well, and not just deal with your parents' grief. Because it's a slippery slope. If you just focus on your parents being bereaved and trying to help them, like, I didn't come back to work for weeks afterwards. And it wasn't necessarily because I didn't feel like I could work. It was because I didn't feel like I could leave my parents. I was in Kilkenny, and I only had, my son was only about 18 months, so he wasn't in school. So I didn't, like, I could stay at home. I could stay in Kilkenny and not be missing out on anything in Dublin. So I did. I just stayed there, and I did not feel. And I remember my boss ringing me and being like, and they were really good, I have to say, they were so good to me in terms of compassionate leave and that. And I remember him ringing me one day, and I went out to the garden to answer the phone, and I was like, I'm actually not ready to come back. I can't leave my mum. I can't walk out this door. I cannot leave her. So I was kind of dealing with her grief and my dad's grief. And I wasn't dealing with my own at all. And I didn't for a good while afterwards. And, you know, the trigger that sent me over the edge was I had another experience of grief 5 or 6 months later. I had a miscarriage, and that grief triggered the grief that I hadn't dealt with around when Cormac died. So I fell apart. That was St. Patrick's Day, St. Patrick's Day, I had a miscarriage. I went into the hospital and I was really sad because, you know, we were trying to have a baby. But that grief hit me then. The grief around Cormac hit me then. And that's when I went into therapy, and it was the best thing I ever did. But again, you go to therapy for one thing and you deal with six things and you come out 2 years later.
Yeah.
So like sending myself to therapy at that time, like I was so against it. I had fought it for years because I knew I had stuff that I needed to deal with. But the trigger was the miscarriage. But I dealt with so much in the next kind of year and a half. I dealt with so much crap, and I parked a lot of stuff, and I aired out all my crap in therapy, and it was the best thing I ever did. But I really badly needed it, and I didn't know, because I was just shutting everything down. And even when Cormac died, I just shut it all down. I was like, I suppose I just didn't feel strong enough to actually delve into it and feel vulnerable and let myself feel weak and let myself fall apart. Because obviously, you know that the only way to build yourself is to just go to ground zero. You know, it's to go down to the worst place and then start again. And I did that with my therapist, Linda. She was amazing. And, you know, I had another kind of crappy experience years later. I went back to her again for another year. And I still remember my last session with her, and I really felt ready for it to be my last session. And I came out and I sat in the car, and Leo Varadkar shut the country down because COVID had hit. And I remember thinking, oh, thank God I got to deal with my shit, because I needed to be in a room with her every week for weeks and weeks and weeks to deal with something that had happened in the previous 3 months. And I remember thinking, God, what are people going to do if they need therapy? How are they going to navigate this pandemic? And I still think about those people, because it would have been a really hard time for people who needed to be around others and needed to be around, you know, support systems and stuff. And to this day, I thank whatever higher power is out there that my brother Cormac didn't have to go through a COVID lockdown. He wouldn't have been able for it. His mental health, he just wouldn't have been able for it. And I'm so glad he wasn't here for that. And I know that's a really hard thing to say and to hear, but he wasn't able for this world, even when the world was functioning normally. So for someone like that to have gone through, you know, lockdown, and what the rest of us all went through in the best of our mental health, or what we thought was a good mental health at the time, he wouldn't have been able. So there's loads of that. There's loads of that stuff I find really sad, you know, around people who had to deal with awful, you know, struggles during COVID. Everything was heightened. Everything was so much harder for those people. And I kind of still get a bit like sad when I think about that, because it definitely amplified feelings of isolation and feelings of, you know, being kind of other or alone or whatever. So yeah, like, I mean, I don't want to get all down on you, like, but I just have a really strong awareness of when people are feeling a little bit just a little bit, you know, vulnerable, because I saw so much of it in Cormac. So I'm just really heightened to that in other people. And I kind of worry for them a little bit.
No, it definitely, like, that was such a difficult time. And I feel like it was like, you know, I think it was like pouring petrol on pre-existing fires. Mm-hmm. Like, the fires are already there and people were battling with these things, and it was just like a multiplier and a magnifier. And again, like, we talk about like access to therapy, mm-hmm. and services, and I really appreciate you sharing your experiences, because like it's already come up in multiple conversations you've had in this series is the power of therapy, and people have gone for multiple different reasons, but kind of just allowing it to be that space that kind of helps you join up some dots, put some pieces of the puzzle together. And hey, I'll be honest, you never really get the full puzzle together. Like, yeah, by the time you get one corner together, the other one's moving over there, and so who hit that corner? It's broken again. I've got to try and come over. But I suppose just trying to have enough pieces together that you feel it's not overwhelming, you know, and that even if it, when it is overwhelming, to have a space to explore, to reflect, I suppose, without, in spaces where people don't have their biases or aren't saying the stereotypical or cliche things, not because they mean any bad, but just because that's what people have always said. You know, I'm sure, again, in my life, I know for a fact people have said to me multiple times, I should just have to get up and get on with it, we just keep going, that's what we do. And like, okay, but also, like, sometimes we need help. And just those different things. And one of the other things I was going to say to you, Van, just before we kind of wrap up, was because I know you shared it in, it was a previous interview, was say when you went back to work after like dealing with that initial grief cycle, or that part of the grief cycle, when you go back and you it's funny because myself and Mary Kate literally had this conversation before, where on the first day back, kind of everyone's like extra nice to you and like, how are you, you're welcome back. But like on day two, it's like, well, we're just working again, so like, you know, that means happening, this story's happening, we have to be over there at 11, and like, and it's okay because ultimately their world and the show goes on, but like it's only one day later and you're still basically feeling and dealing with all your stuff, and that can be hard, like as you try and reintegrate into other people's world and the world around you, like that can be really hard and difficult. But I really appreciated you sharing that, because it's something that had come up in literally a previous conversation in our lives as well.
Yeah, like when you go back to work and it doesn't matter what you do, you walk in and nothing has changed in the office, nothing has changed in the day-to-day life of, you know, doing the job that people are doing around you, but your whole world is completely different. Like my whole world was completely different. My family was changed. I was broken. My family was broken. Like, and I mean that in the sense of like we were sad and grieving and it was awful. And yet everything is normal around you and it's really hard. And like, it's not that dissimilar. Like grief is one thing, but like when something changes in your life, like something huge happens, it's amazing to me that you just go back in and everything's meant to be the same. Like I remember the very same thing when I went back after having my first child, I went back to the office and I was like, oh my God, I'm a completely different person. I'm responsible for a human being that I've left at home with somebody I barely know, like a childminder or whatever. And yet I'm in here and I'm expected to completely focus what I'm doing here, even though half my brain is at home still. Sure. So it's quite similar, but I suppose that's just something that we all have to navigate. Like, you know, you do sometimes have to get the head down and get on with it. And like that builds resilience as well. And I think resilience is one of the things I think maybe people are growing up without a lot of, or with less of possibly than we had. So I suppose when you're going through something like that, you are showing, you know, your kids or, you know, younger people about resilience, or even just trying to put one foot in front of the other, because no one's going to do it for you. Like,
no, and speaking of resilience, I think we'll wrap up on this one, because like obviously my own work as a mental performance coach, like I would always break down like resilience as a mental skill, and it's something that we can develop and we can get better at. And for sure, if society or there's younger people who, you know, feel like, okay, they aren't as resilient, but okay, well, what can we expose them to, or how can we develop that skill set? But also as adults, how do we develop it? And like, I'm still developing it all the time. And I thought, just as we wrap up in terms of, because I know you've got to go and I'm sure there's kids waiting to be collected, or I hope they're not waiting, but we'll get you there on time. But I believe you signed up to do a marathon in terms of resilience. And I think you saw, even you posted this morning as we were talking, you're trying to get a run done. We started the conversation with you being busy, like in challenges. And I see your eyes roll there. Like, talk to us, offloaded.
First of all, it's a half marathon. Mark my words, I will never do a marathon. I told you, the first thing I said to you was I always like to challenge myself and find a challenge. I love the gym, I'd lift weights all day long, so it's not a challenge. I hate running, and I know that, you know, it's healthy, you know, it's good for us to get out, and I'm not talking about, I actually don't think it's good for me at 42 to start to try and run a marathon. But yeah, I signed up for a half marathon in September. So, and I'm starting from scratch. So, because I hate running, and the furthest I've ever run is 10K, and that was before I had my kids, right? So I'm trying to build it, but I'm still in the phase of trying to enjoy it. I do not enjoy it. It is absolute torture. The first kilometer is just pain. And then after a while, then sometimes you do get into it. But today I went for a run and it just, the whole 6K was awful. Awful. Like, I wanted to do 8, but I just turned around at a section. I knew if I turned around now, it'd be 6, just so I could get home. Like, it was awful. So I'm assuming that you're going to have awful days, and you're going, like, last week I did 8 and I felt great afterwards. I felt fine. I felt like I probably could have kept going. In fact, I did 8.5, and I remember thinking I could have done 10, and then I would have had 10 done. But anyway, today was not that day. So yeah, I'm just hoping that it clicks. And again, yeah, it is just a little challenge for myself to see, can I do it? And I've got the kind of personality, like if calm hell or high water, I'm doing it, like whether I have to walk at the end or whatever, I will do it. But I do not have the desire to tick the marathon box. It's not about running a marathon. It's about just, oh, let's see if I can just get into running. And I don't want to do loads of half marathons. I just want to do one and say, oh, I did a half marathon. Yeah. And then maybe by the time I actually do the bloody thing, I'll enjoy getting out twice a week for 6 or 8K. Like, I don't want to be a runner. I just wouldn't mind being a little bit fitter and keeping an eye on it. And I think you're kind of setting a good example for your kids as well, if you're staying active. I really do believe that. 100%. If they grow up in that environment, it's normal. You know, and they are both really, you know, involved in sport. And my daughter is probably stronger than I am. She trains like 14 hours a week in the gym. She's 8. So she is well used to, you know, being in that environment. But she also sometimes comes to my gym and she sees me. And I think that's a really good message too. Like, you know, because in her head, I'm old. Like, I'm old and uncool and ancient and broken. But I go to the gym. So hopefully when she's 42, she'll go to the gym and stay healthy.
No, I think that, like, I think you're right. And it is like, so like, you know, our actions and doing stuff. And even though I half laughed there, because during like the pandemic and stuff, Joe, everyone went through that, like that running phrase. I did been through it. And as you know, I played in goals all my life. So, like, yeah. I hated running. Like, I never liked it. And it, as I tried to do it, I did this thing where I kept like looking at the watch and I was like measuring every kilometer and what my speed was and almost being overly analytical. And one of my good friends who's like involved as like a strength and conditioning coach and like high level sports, he was like, listen, you're not trying to win a marathon. Forget about all that. Like, set a timer on your watch for amount of time you want to run for. He goes, on average, you'll run about this pace anyway. So just like zoom out of all of that stuff. So set a timer for like 30 minutes on your watch and just run for the 30 minutes. Like, don't stop until it beeps and kind of just getting out of your head. And it genuinely helped me. I'm not going to say I loved running now at all, but it definitely helped me kind of find that flow a little bit more and kind of alleviate the pressure and the expectation you put on yourself because it's measuring every 1 kilometer. Something that came to mind as a shared
video. Maybe
I'll
do that. Like, I'm not really looking at the kilometers. I don't check the thing when I'm running. I don't look at timings. I don't look at pace. I'm just thinking, oh, when can I stop? When can I get home?
I get home.
If I turn around now, I'll be home. I just do not enjoy it one bit. But hopefully that'll click. By the next time we talk, Alan, maybe I'll have clicked. And maybe I'll enjoy running.
I believe in you. When is the half marathon?
September.
You got this.
Yeah.
Listen, Van, I'm really conscious of your time and I want to thank you for your time and I want to thank you for sharing your story and experiences and your life's journey with us. Like, I think on the podcast this season, we've been so fortunate to capture such a variety and depth of stories from different walks of life. And I'm really, really glad I got to talk to you and to add your story to this series, because one of the things that makes me so proud and why I'm passionate about doing this work is I know someone will be, you know, driving their car right now or walking or cycling or having or listening to this conversation and the stuff that we've talked about, the storytelling, the empathy, the shared lessons. I really appreciate you kind of showing up and adding to that. I just want to thank you because I really appreciate it. So thanks a lot for joining us on the Real Talks podcast.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Real Talks podcast. The Real Talks podcast is hosted by me, Alan O'Mara, and produced by Mary Kate Boylan. Video and audio were mixed and edited by Jack Deacon at Plural Video and Design. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Real Talks podcast on your preferred platform to keep up to date with our new weekly episodes. You can also sign up for our newsletter at www.realtalks.news. You can also follow the podcast at Hey Real Talks on Instagram and TikTok. And you can follow me there by searching at AOMTheCat. Thanks for being here, and we'll be back next week. This episode of the Real Talks podcast is brought to you thanks to the MGF Group, a premier building material supplier in New York City. Whether you're a seasoned contractor or a DIY enthusiast, the MGF Group offers a wide range of premium building materials to suit your every need. From cement to lumber, protection materials and safety nets, the MGF Group has got it all under one roof and pride themselves in timely and reliable delivery. Check out the mgfgroup.com for more information.
This episode of the Real Talks podcast is brought to you thanks to the Taylor Public House. Right on the doorstep of Madison Square Garden, the Taylor Public House is the perfect place to connect with family or friends before taking in a concert or sports event. The Taylor is known for its warm welcome, classy ambiance, and comfort food. It has 2 floors, 3 bars, and 2 private event spaces for parties and gatherings. Be sure to stop by and experience the Taylor Public House for yourself, located in the heart of Midtown Manhattan on the corner of 35th Street and 8th Avenue. Check out thetaylornyc.com for more information.